My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't found necessary to take a drink, nor have I had a drink, since January 25th, 1981. And for that, I'm grateful to God and some wonderful, wonderful sponsors and mentors, whom I'll probably talk about during the next hour and for the next 12 weeks. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a privilege. Thank you, Railroad Bob, for making the mistake of inviting me again. I get to do this once a year here and sometimes at the 101 Club and different places around the deal. And it is a great privilege to do this. And I'm going to share some of my own thoughts and feelings, and don't get too upset about anything I say. You know, I have a tendency to upset people from time to time. And you know what the spiritual axiom is: whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. Right? So if I disturb you, you owe me $10. It's like a copayment because I've given you a spiritual MRI. And you see, I don't care what I say. I'll go out of here. I'll drive home and I'll say, "Why did I say that?" I'll change my mind, and you'll be thinking about me for 16 months. You know, and until you do an inventory and talk to your sponsor and pray about it, and then 8 years from now you'll come up to me and say, "I used to hate you, but now I love you," and all that stuff. And so this is presumably a step one meeting. Well, listen, here's the way it's going to work. It's going to be whatever it's going to be. You know, it's step one. It's going to be all the steps, because life is about all the steps in a nanosecond at once. What step this is going to be for you is really going to depend upon where you're at, because you're going to see the world not the way it is, but the way you're at, the way you are. Because I've done enough meetings all over the world to, you know, I've spoken and had people come up to me and after an hour talk say, "You know what really got to me when you said this?" And sometimes it's actually something I said. And you know, and I've had people come up to me and they picked out something I've said and they say, "That really made the third step, you know, that really helped me out with the third step." And in the same talk, somebody else has picked something else out and said, "That really helped me with the 10th step." Or helped me. And the bottom line is, this is a God thing. This is a God-centered thing. One time I was doing the steps about almost 30 years ago, 29 years ago, down at the Homestead Group. And I had about 2 years, and I was doing the steps at the Homestead Group, and I don't know, I was doing a meeting on the fourth step or something like that, and it was probably the worst four-step meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, you know, I was still pretty self-centered at the time, worrying about what people thought about me and stuff like that, and nobody was laughing or clapping. Whatever it was, I didn't feel like I wasn't going to come back. I wasn't going to come back, you know. I mean, one of the things that happens to you in Alcoholics Anonymous is if you don't want to drink, you know, as an alcoholic, I'm also an excuse-aholic. I'm a self-pity-aholic. I'm a lot of holics. But one of the things you are, if you're an alcoholic, you're a born excuse-aholic. In other words, no matter what you have to do, pay the mortgage, you know, feed the baby, no matter how important it is, you can figure out an excuse why you weren't there and why you didn't do it. So as an alcoholic, I'm sure I could have figured out an excuse not to show up, but I had a great thing happen to me. And the greatest thing that happened to me is I didn't want to drink. I can't tell you how badly I didn't want to drink. I wanted to stay sober so badly that I found myself doing stuff and listening to people, hearing stuff and performing things and doing stuff I didn't want to do. Because I had some, I don't know, abusive sponsor. Somehow, I couldn't stop drinking. Anybody ever had that problem? I mean, I couldn't stop. I'd wake up and say, "I'm not going to have a drink today," and then by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm drinking. "I'm not going to go to the bar today," by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm at the bar. "I'm not going to buy booze today," by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm searching for dimes, nickels, and quarters to buy a quart bottle of Carlos Rossi Chianti so I can drink it while listening to my radio. I could not. So finally, I said, I was 31 years old. I thought my life was over. It was never going to be better again. I couldn't envision life without drinking. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I stopped drinking. I had no idea why I stopped drinking. I couldn't stop drinking. If you could have stopped drinking, you'd suffer from a different disease. I drank for what they say in the book. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I didn't know I drank for the effect. I didn't know any of this stuff I'm talking about now. This is after 32 years of doing this stuff, of course. But I drank for the effect produced by alcohol. I'm restless. I'm an alcoholic. I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent, unless you get an experience, a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. You know, my disease, you know, I thought the problem was alcohol because I became addicted to alcohol, and that's what they arrest you for. They don't arrest you for driving while feeling sorry for yourself, or driving while lusting, or driving while coveting, or driving while... They arrest you for driving while drinking while driving. So that's where I was getting into trouble. But the truth of the matter is, my drinking, I drank. Drinking, like I say in the book, was a symptom of my disease. It was what I used. I drank alcohol because no woman, no car, no amount of money, and I used them all, worked quite as well and quite as fast as just a few drinks. And if it worked for me today the way it worked for me back then, I'd probably still be drinking. But of course, the story of my life is that alcohol no longer works for me. And unfortunately, the sad story about my life is alcohol stopped working for me about 10 years before I realized it stopped working for me, and I hurt a lot of people. And I lost a lot myself, and I lost my self-respect, my self-esteem, and a lot of stuff, you know? So I'm over there at the Homestead Group and doing this thing, and I did the, as I said, the worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wasn't going to go back because it's all about me, and what do they think about me, and they don't like me, but of course I was going back because I made a commitment and I didn't want to drink, and I had all these crazy ideas. Unfortunately, you're catching me at 32 years sober, unfortunately, because like the people in the book, I know but a little. You know, that's what they say in the book. They say, I know, but isn't that what they say? We read this book. We base our lives on these guys who wrote this book. You get the last page. You know what they say? We know but a little. Our whole life is based upon following these guys. We get to the end of the book. They say, we don't know shit. We don't know nothing. I mean, there's 15,000 alcoholics and a banana out there, and they know everything. I knew everything. You know, before I came in here, I knew everything. Didn't you? I was smarter than anybody. I knew everything. I come in here. Because even though I knew everything, because of bad breaks and misunderstandings, my life was in the toilet. You understand what I'm saying? Sometimes that happens to you. It wasn't my fault. It was somebody else's fault. So I came in here knowing everything. And now I'm 32 years sober, and I know nothing. And everything's wonderful. You know, I'm self-supporting through my own contributions. I got 4 kids, married 32 years, you know, 6 grandkids. And I know nothing. Well, that's not true. I know a few things. But I'll tell you, the things I know, I absolutely know without any doubt whatsoever. I'm going to share a few of those things with you. It's just a few. You know, you can stay sober and be at peace with yourself just by knowing 2 or 3 things. You don't even have to know a lot of stuff, just 2 or 3 things. The stuff I know is phenomenal, is incredible, and you know what's great about it? Not only do I know it absolutely, but it happens to be true. You know, it can be a horrible thing if you know stuff and it's not true. If you like, if you absolutely know that you don't have a problem with drinking and it's not true, that could be a problem. Do you know before people come in here, you know, when they're alcoholics out there drinking, they'll tell you to your face, I don't have a drinking problem. I said that. I'd say something like, well, I know you're seeing what you're seeing and looking the way you're looking. You think I have a drinking problem. I know that's clear to you, but, you know, your problem is, I said, if you knew a little bit about my life, if you knew a little bit about me, if you understood the little nuances of my life, if you understood every time I tried to make it all work out right and it turned to crap in my hands, you'd understand I don't have a drinking problem. I drink because I have problems. And pretty soon my problems, as a matter of fact, my drinking perfectly matches my problems. And pretty soon my problems are going to go away, and I won't have to drink anymore. So I really appreciate your advice, but why don't you go screw yourself? You know, and that's sort of like the way I would talk to you if you approached me, if you had the temerity of approaching me to talk to me about my drinking. It was sort of like, you can talk to me about my drinking, but I'm going to talk to you about yourself and everything I know about you and your mother. You know what I mean? It ain't going to be for free. And, you know, and so I, before I came in here, I knew everything. And I was destroying my life. You know, Carl Menninger, a few years before the big book was written, wrote a book called Man Against Himself. And in the chapter of alcoholism, he said, alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. And, you know, I've sponsored, you know, really, literally hundreds of thousands. I'm not even sure, a lot of people, a lot of men, worked with a lot of men. And I've seen a lot of women in here. You know, after 32 years, you see a lot, you know. You see a lot. You know, you get a lot of experience. I had a lot of experience out there. I got a lot of experience. You know, my sponsor used to say, Russ, when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with money will have walked away with an experience. So, you know, I know alcoholics sitting around bars will tell you all their opinions, how much they know, and they'll say things like, well, I don't know, I haven't done the third step, but this is what I think. I haven't done the fourth step, this is what I think, you know, but I can tell you something. Based upon my experience, Carl Menninger is right. Alcoholics are men and women out to destroy themselves. That's why if you sponsor people and you watch alcoholics, you say things to yourself like, I don't get it. Why does he keep on drinking? I don't get it. He's in jail again. I don't get it. She lost her kids again. That's why nobody understands alcoholics. I don't get it. She lost her kids again. She drank again. She was here last week. Because alcoholics are hair triggered to kill themselves. Because if you're an alcoholic, you hate yourself. Now, I know you don't hate yourself. I know you love yourself because you're the greatest thing in the world. But in between the times you think you're the greatest thing in the world, and so I know, but in between the times you think you're special and the greatest thing in the world, I'm talking about the times when you think you're a piece of shit. Sometimes if you're an alcoholic, it's not, yeah, I know, you're laughing. You don't know what it's like. Sometimes if you're an alcoholic, you can actually hold those two thoughts in your mind at the same time. I'm incredible, I'm a piece of shit. And, you know, it sets up some sort of friction. It sets up some sort of, well, you see, that's why we drink. Because when you drink, it sort of all bolts together and the fear goes away and you feel on top of the world for a nanosecond. You know, and that's the deal, and that's the problem. That's why men drink, because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Because our problem is not alcohol. It becomes alcohol, I'm sure, but our problem is that we're sober. We drink because to sobriety to an alcoholic is horrible. It's a horrible life. Interspersed by a couple of moments of excitement, and you get laid once in a while, and you buy a car, or whatever it is, and you're okay for a nanosecond, and then it's off to the worry, and the fear, and the bullshit, and I can't believe this happened to me again, and who do they think they are, and they don't know who they're screwing with, and I'll show them, and that's the deal. And that's a whole life of that, one after another. 10,000 thoughts coming at you at 3 o'clock in the morning, all at the same time, all bad thoughts about yourself and other people. And you're alone. And that's what it's like to be an alcoholic. So you go out and try to get laid, or you try to get a car, or anything to distract you from the horribleness of your life, and booze does it better than anything else. You know, and if alcohol did for you what it did for me, you'd drink it too. I can tell you that. Nothing worked quite as well as just a few drinks for me. And so I didn't get here. So I just thought I'd tell you that, just in case you thought that maybe I wasn't an alcoholic, because I'm not going to talk much about booze during this series. This ain't going to be about booze. This is going to be about my favorite topic, Bill Wilson's favorite topic, the next frontier, emotional sobriety. Because I happen to sponsor a lot of guys that have 20, you know, 25, 26 years that are brittle and dry as you can't even imagine. It is possible to stay sober for many years and not be rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence and experience much of heaven. Did you know that? It's true. People worry, well, wonder why people drink and everything like that. So we're going to talk a little bit about this. So I'm at Homestead. Remember, I do this, you know. You're going to have to pay attention because I make some hard right turns. So I'm at the Homestead group. And I just did what? The worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've looked it up in the Guinness Book of World Records. And as far as I know, it is still the worst four-step meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was not going to come back, but you know what happened? But I didn't want to stop. I didn't want to drink. And somehow I tied into not talking to my sponsor and not going to meetings and not doing what you said you were going to do with drinking. And so as much as I knew they hated me, and I knew they hated me, and I knew they didn't like me, and I knew the meeting was bad, I somehow felt in my mind if I didn't go back to the meeting and fulfill my responsibility, I might drink. And, you know, I would do anything not to drink. So I had to go back, so I went back there. So I'm at the podium like I'm at here right now, and before the meeting starts, some guy comes up to me, and he says the following. He says this to, this is the great thing about alcohol. It says our stories disclose. Well, this is a true story. This is my story. Our stories, this is a story. All I got is 32 years of stories. That's all I got for you. So he comes up to me, and this is what the guy says. He says, you saved my life. This is what he says to me. Imagine this. I had just finished, what? There. The worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Without question. It's already been documented. It's in the Guinness Book of World Records. I knew it was the worst meeting. You knew because my brilliant mind thought it was the worst meeting. I was just in Alcoholics Anonymous, and even though I was the smartest person in the world before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had 2 years, so I wasn't really the smartest person in the world. I understood I wasn't the smartest person in the world. There were some things I could learn, but I was like a notch down from the smartest person in the world. You know, I'm like when you have 2 years or 3 years and you start thinking, you know how we are in Alcoholics Anonymous, we come in unemployable, 3 weeks later we're underpaid, you know what I mean? And you know how it is. We can't, I'll do anything to get a job, but you know, I keep shitting in my pants, who's going to give me a job? And then you get a job 3 weeks later, you say they're screwing you because you should be getting more, I should be running this joint, you know, and you know. So, in any event, so the bottom line is, so this guy comes to me, he says, you saved my life. I said, what? He says, yeah. He says, that meeting you did, I guess that meeting was for him. I don't know. That meeting you did last week, last week, he says, I was going to go out and drink, and I have like 3 months and everything like that, and my wife left me, and the kids left me, and I lost my job, you know. And I was going to drink, and I was going to come in here and just, you know, go to one more meeting, you know what I mean? And I was going to drink, and I was sitting in the back of the room, and you didn't see me. And when you said, the chicken is on the roof. The entire program came together for me. And I saw white light and I saw God, you know. And no, now, of course, I had never said the chicken was on the roof, but, you know, I didn't tell him that. I was still smart enough to take credit for it. Oh, yeah, chicken. I, at some point in the talk, I had mentioned something about poultry. I can't remember what it was, but it wasn't chicken on the roof. He got it all wrong. It was I said the turkey is in the basement. But you see, the funny thing is about this deal is the way this thing is. It says, here I am, you know, just trying to carry a message. You know what that meeting taught me? It taught me about the 12th step. I didn't know that doing that meeting taught me about, and that guy taught me about the 12th step because you see. I was so worried about what people thought about me because I thought what the 12 steps said is that we carry the message. That's what I thought. I thought the 12 steps said we carry the message. So if my job is to carry the message, then it's a heavy responsibility. And that means if you don't get the message, I screwed up. Or if you drink, I did something wrong. And I didn't know that I didn't have to carry the message. I didn't know that all I had to do was try to carry the message. I thought it was my responsibility that you get the message. Hell, I don't even know what message you're getting. I don't even know what you're hearing what I'm saying. God takes care of whether the message is carried. Whether you get the message has more to do with you than me. All I have to do is get up there and try. And I was up there trying to carry the message, not really realizing that's what I was doing. I thought I had to carry the message. When you think you have to carry the message, then you worry about whether you're given the worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. But when you're just trying to carry the message, it may be the worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's the best meeting you can do that night. So you fulfilled your responsibility. You understand what I'm saying? So this guy tells me, when you said chicken on the roof, and I really said turkey on the bed, but here the deal is, I'm trying to carry the message. He's back there, and he wants to stay sober. He doesn't want to drink, and he has no idea what's going on. And across the room floats the statement, turkey in the basement. And it goes, turkey in the basement, all the way to the back of the room. And he's sitting in the back of the room, and he's listening. And turkey in the basement goes in his ears. And God does what God does best. He knows the piece that's missing from this guy's heart is chicken on the roof. And he hears chicken on the roof. And he comes up here to thank me because I get the credit. And it has nothing to do with me. So who knows whether this is a first step meeting or what the hell's going on here, right? Who knows what you're going to get out of this? You know, at these prices, you can't complain. So here you go. So let me read this thing. This is on page 29, okay? Page 29. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we have recovered. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. Let me read that to you again. This is the pure AA. See, you can either understand what AA is about, or you can live your life like most people based upon the, quote, wisdom of the rooms. Very often you'll find that the wisdom of the rooms, the, quote, wisdom of the room, is counter to AA because the rooms are made up of, you ready for this? This is scary, alcoholics. In various stages of sobriety, most of whom would rather really not do this stuff. Would rather live off of what people tell them or wishful thinking or not do the hard stuff. And if they get a sponsor or somebody that tells them to do something that's hard, they say, I'm going to screw that guy. I'm going to get somebody who likes me, a friend, you know, the guy hurt my feelings or stuff like that. I mean, because I don't know how to tell you this, but it wasn't long before I went up to my sponsor complaining about Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, well, Russell, you must have thought you were joining Well People's Anonymous. And it is not. And so you hear all sorts of stuff in here you would like to believe that is untrue. Like, people will tell you that this isn't really, you know, that I'm spiritual, not religious. I'm spiritual, not religious. You know, I'm a recovering Catholic. You know, like, there's something wrong with religion. If you hang around lay long enough, you'll think there's something wrong with religion. There's something wrong with organized religion. That if you talk about organized religion or the Bible or something like that or Jesus or whatever it is, that's a bad thing. You'll say that because alcoholics don't like the idea of God. They hate the idea of God. That's why they wrote something called a Chapter of the Agnostics. It's to the agnostics and atheists. You understand? There's only one chapter to the agnostics. The rest of the book is to the believers. And the only thing the chapter of the agnostics says is, get over it. This sort of thinking has to be abandoned. You understand what I'm saying? That's what it says. And you know what the book says? It says we begin to see where religious people are right. We lose prejudice against organized religion. Well, if you hung around Alcoholics Anonymous and just lived off the wisdom of the room, you'd think organized religion bad. Alcoholics Anonymous, good. You wouldn't realize that in the book on several occasions they say we encourage church membership, that all of us are members of churches, because that's what we do when we start really wanting to know him better and get close to him, because our book says after they lost those old ideas and they knew but a little, you know, you got to get rid of those old ideas or the result is nil. So after they lost all those old ideas, you know, all the old ideas that were getting them drunk and getting them in trouble, they were left, after you take out all those old ideas, you're left with knowing only a little, right? So all you got is these new ideas, but you know those real well. You know the new ideas, like see to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Like resentment is the number one offender. You know, you see new ideas, like God should be the centerpiece of your life. You know, the new ideas, you know, that God's doing for you what you can't do for yourself. There is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. If we sincerely make this decision, all sorts of remarkable things happen. Being all powerful. No, he's not the higher power. He's the highest power. He's all powerful, you know. He will give you everything you need if you stay close to him and perform his works well. You start knowing those things, and you know those things well, and just by knowing those things, you don't have to know much of anything else because you know God's going to be in control. You're not going to manage anything. How are you going to manage anything? You have any power. Every meeting they go to, they say you're an alcoholic. You can't manage your own life. That no human power could relieve your alcoholism. Then you go to the room, and then you walk outside, you get in your car, and you start figuring out how you're going to manage your life. Or how are you going to find a human power, a guy or a girl, to manage your life with you or help your life with you? And it all falls to pieces, and you come crying back to the discussion meeting saying, I don't understand what's going on. When the book is telling you God couldn't, what if he was sought? And you're still trying to manage your life. Because you don't want to do it because you're an alcoholic and your hair triggered to do just the opposite. Because you're right-handed and you'll always be right-handed. And if you operate with your right hand, you're going to die. And you come to AA and they say, use your left hand. Your left hand, dude, use the God hand. And use the God hand a couple of times and say, hey, this thing is good. I'm never going to stop using this thing. And you walk outside and somebody puts out their arm and you put out your right hand. Because this feels comfortable and that feels uncomfortable. Because you got to go to 16 meetings, have a crazy sponsor, and read the Bible and do all sorts of stuff in order just to get and hang around people that are talking about it, just to get in the continuous situation, so you're constantly thinking about God and focusing on God. Because as soon as you walk out there, the first billboard you see, the first movie you see, the first guy you hang out with or gal you hang out with that starts talking about enlarged breasts or, you know, or Viagra or something like that, you're into worldly clamors just like Bill Wilson is. And the next thing you know, you're feeling shitty about yourself because you feel you're insufficient, because the entire world is a giant mirror that's basically explaining to you that you're not good enough. And you're wondering why you drink and why people drink, why 0.5% stay sober for 20 years or more. Congratulations on your 21 years. It's a great thing. So what is this thing about? It says, further on, clear-cut directions are given shown how we recover. They are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he establishes his relationship with God. So what is AA about? What is an AA testimony about? What is an AA witnessing story about? Is it about I drank, you know, all AA stories, I blah, 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 and then I drank. Blah, 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 and then I drank. And then I drank. Or, you know, listen, I did that in the bars. You know what AA is about? It's about how you establish your relationship with God. That's what it says in the book. If you make this decision sincerely, all sorts of remarkable things happen. You know, you'll become reborn. That's what it says in the book. So then it says early on in the book, and there is a solution, it says the following. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Listen, did they read the fifth chapter before we... You know, in every meeting they read that, right? That fifth chapter? Doesn't it say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path? Does it say that?
Yeah.
Has anybody ever heard that?
Yeah.
Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Okay, so that means... I'll tell you what I think that means. This is my opinion. I could be wrong. I think it means that... Listen, if you do what we did... you'll get what we got. It's like a recipe. You know, if I give you a recipe to make a chocolate cake, you say, this is the greatest chocolate cake in the world. Russell, I love this chocolate cake. Can I have the recipe? And I give you the recipe of the chocolate cake, and all of a sudden you go home to make it, and you say, you know something? He uses eggs. I'm going to use egg beaters. You know, he put it in the oven at 350 degrees for 30 minutes. I want it a little bit faster. I'm going to put it on in at 500 degrees for 10 minutes. You just change it a little bit because it's like easier and faster. Now, you may get a cake. He uses chocolate. I'm going to use like sugarless chocolate. You just change a little thing here and there, make it easy for you. You know something? You're going to get a cake. You might even call it a chocolate cake. But you're going to taste it. You're going to say, this doesn't taste like Russell's cake. It's like my number is 305-442-0200. Listen, you dial that number, you're going to get me. Now, if you dial 305-442-0201, you're not going to get me. It doesn't matter how much you want to get me. It doesn't matter how many times you dial that number. You understand what I'm saying? You ain't going to get me because you're not dialing the right number. It says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, which means I guess you got, then you're ready to take a certain, you're not even ready to take the steps unless you want what we have. You have to develop a we. Somebody, there are people in AA that they don't want what we have. They're here because for a million different reasons. Maybe to find cover, get back in the big bed, get their job back, whatever it is, they don't want what we have. Or even if they wanted what we had, they're just not willing to give up Sally, she's a heroin addict, but, I love her, they're not willing to go to any length to do it, They don't want it, they don't have the desire. You can give all sorts of people book learning, you can give them the book, you can talk to them. If they don't have the desire, you can't do that. I can't give you the desire, I can't do that. I can't somehow put you in a situation where you'll do anything to have what he has. Where to have that desire is more important than having sex, is more important than going out with girls, is more important than money, is more important than anything. I can't do that for you. That's a God thing and something that has to do with you. And so, here we have, it says, we have found much of heaven. So this is what happened to these guys. They said, if you do what we did, you'll get what we've got. He says, we found much of heaven and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence which we had not even dreamed. How many people would like that? Okay, listen, I think, now this is just my opinion, I could be wrong, that they're not talking about not drinking. See, they could have said, we stopped drinking. They could have said that. They didn't say we stopped drinking. They said, we have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Which I think is something different than not drinking. And I'll tell you why I think it's different than not drinking. I've hung around AA for a long time, and I've been in AA for a long time. I've watched a lot of people in AA who don't drink. And I was at a time in my life where I just didn't drink. And I can promise you, after watching people in AA, not everybody is rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which he had not even dreamed, or experiencing much of heaven. There are a few people, most are in the fellowship of the thumb-sucking crybabies. That's why we have all our discussion meetings. So we can all talk about what happened to us and, why it happened to us and how life isn't fair and all that sort of stuff. You know what I mean? So we can do that sort of stuff, It says the great fact is just this and nothing less. This is the great fact. You all want like the bottom. Here's the great fact. And nothing less, which I think means, you ready for this? What does that mean? Nothing less. Great fact is this and nothing less. You see, alcoholics have a funny way of thinking. I say the great fact is this is nothing less. And the first thing an alcoholic says is, oh, no, I don't have to do all that. I can get less. He said what they hear is the great fact, just like chicken on the roof, they hear the great fact is this, but it could be less. I don't have to do that God thing. I don't have to do that church thing. I don't have to do that thing. I'm spiritual, not religious. Spiritual, not religious. I'm not spiritual. I'm 32 years sober. I know exactly what I am. I lived with myself for 31 years when I wasn't in here. I've lived with myself when I'm in here. I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I'm filled with 1,000 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. I'll step on the toes of others. They retaliate. You think I'm somehow some sort of quality of spiritualness? Just take me out of these rooms for 5 seconds and put me in a position where the check bounces and watch how spiritual I am. I am a selfish, self-centered, egomaniac, worried about myself, not caring about anybody else. Anything you see in me that is good or decent or anything is the reflection of him, his personality, and me. I told my sponsor once when I blew up and I got angry, I said, well, that's just my personality. He says, Russell, it's your personality that's killing you. That's why we separate the men from the boys. You know what it says the men are in our 12, and 12? It says a well-loved clergyman. That's right. I know in AA you think that we hate clergymen and we shouldn't talk about clergymen, but clergymen help start this thing. A well-loved clergyman set down the test for, what the difference is between the men and the boys. He says any man and woman
who will try repeatedly these steps on all his defects has a right to be called a man who is trying to grow in the image and likeness of his creator. What the heck do you think he was talking about? The doorknob? Well, I guess if you were created by a doorknob, I guess if you were created... So anything you say to me that's good or decent, which is probably very little, or attractive, has nothing to do with me. It has to do with his spirit in me as a result of doing these things and wanting this so badly. That's the body. I don't care whether you like it or not. You don't have to like it. I see people drink all the time. I see people turn their back on this thing all the time. I'm not here for a popularity contest. They don't pay me enough money for that. You know what I mean? I'm here just to tell you the truth the way I see it. And when you talk about the truth the way you see it, you don't even need notes. You can talk fast. And if you don't worry about what people think about you, you don't even have to run it through the filter of, well, will they like this? Or what will they think if I like that? You can talk fast. So here it is. The great fact is this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today. The central fact of our lives today. Repeat after me. The central fact of our lives today. Now listen, let me suggest something to you. If they're saying the central fact of their lives today, this must be, you ready for this? The central fact of their lives today. Now, if getting laid, you're all adults and alcoholics, right? I mean, I want to talk about something that alcoholics think about all the time, okay? If getting laid is the central fact of your life today, then all you think about is getting laid. Now, I understand that, being a guy who used to hang out with bars, going out every Saturday and Friday night, that's all I thought about. That's all I thought about during the week. That's all I thought about. And I hung around with other guys who were alcoholics, and that's all they thought about. And that's all they talked about. They would say things like this. Look at that one over there. Look at that one over there. Look at that. Get a load of her. Hey, look at the drugs on that one. Hey, look at that one. You see, because when the central fact of your life is having sex or having sex with somebody because you need to do that because you feel so crappy about yourself, you need some good-looking gal or somebody to at least accept you so at least you can feel acceptable to yourself. When that's the central fact of your whole life revolves around that. You make sure you have a brand new car. You say, if I only had a brand new car, because then I can attract her. You know what I mean? You make sure if I only had this, you're going to attract her. You're gonna have, and women do the same thing with guys. If I only had the new haircut, if I only had the new nails, if I only weighed 50 pounds, all the vanity stuff, because that's all they think about, because that's the central fact of their lives. And you know what it says in the big book? It says that stuff doesn't work in the 12 and 12. It says that doesn't work. Never did we get enough of that stuff. Romance. Money, power, or romance. It says it doesn't work. But you know something? When you're right-handed and all you do is think about that and you're comfortable thinking about that and all your friends think about that and that's the only thing they're showing in the movies out there and everything like that, you think that you're perfectly normal. And the only people that aren't talking about that are the people who talk about God and they're like weird. And people laugh at them. And God knows alcoholics don't want to be laughed at. You know, they want to fit in. Right? So the bottom line is, the central fact of your life is who you are. And you will hang out with people that talk about that central fact. The man and woman you'll be 5 years from now will depend upon the people you hang out with and the books you read. And trust me, the books you read will depend upon the people you hang out with. I've never seen it fail. People who get solid, decent, peaceful, serene, emotionally stable sobriety always are hanging around, will tell you about people they're hanging around. They'll talk about their sponsors, their mentors. They're not hanging around whack jobs. Unless they're hanging around the whack job in order to try to 12-step in and help them and everything like that. And that's just to help them. They're not going to sit there and set up camp. Now, I've never seen it. And it's you become who you hang out with. Because who you hang out with, you hang out with guys and gals that want to talk about bullshit. You want to talk about sports and broads and this, that, and the other thing. You're going to talk about that all day. And when you get in your car, that's what you're going to be thinking about. You talk about men that are talking about God or trying to talk about doing service to him and everything like that. That's all you're going to be thinking about. That's all you're going to be talking about. When you get in your car, you're going to be thinking and talking about that until you get to your next meeting. And that's the way it works. It's as simple as that. It says here, the central fact of our lives today, these are these guys that you want to be like, is the absolute certainty. What is it? Absolute certainty. You understand what that means? That means they're not only certain, they're absolutely certain. You understand? There's no wiggle room here. You know, you read this stuff. If you actually read this stuff, take time to read it instead of thinking that A is about acceptance is the answer to all my problems. Not. If acceptance was the answer to all your problems, we wouldn't have a big book. We would have like a matchbook cover. It would just say acceptance is the answer to all your problems. Not. Sometimes courage, all the time faith in God. As a matter of fact, you couldn't even have a shot of acceptance if you didn't have faith. You'd just be thinking about yourself and worrying about yourself. But you wanted something. If acceptance is the answer to all your problems, then you don't have to read the rest of the book. You could think that's what AA is all about. It says, the essential factor of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could not do by ourselves. Who would he be talking about? He must be talking about him. That's why those guys said, we know but a little. So your real reliance must always be upon him. Now listen, this is my opinion. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the group you're involved with. I don't care what they're saying in this group. I don't care what the old timer in the back room saying, just put the plug in the jug and that crap. This is what you're involved in. This is what AA is all about. So we got this picture right here. And that guy right there is... This is the man on the bed, famous man on the bed. You know, has everybody seen this? Has anybody who's not seen this? This is a rendition. Let me tell you who's there. This is Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. His story is in the book. His name is Bill Dotson. He was a lawyer. He clocked a nurse when he got into the hospital. You know, this is Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. And if you read Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, he talks about what happened and what they said when they 12-stepped to him. They go through the 12-step call. And this is a rendition of what he looks like. I mean, I want you to check this out. You know what's cool about it? Now, this happened prior to the publishing of the big book. Bill Dotson came in between 1935 and... Now, listen. The big book was published... Listen, you guys can handle facts, right? Okay, can you handle facts? Okay. The big book was published in 1939. A was started in 1935. So when you read in that book where they say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, their path did not include reading the big book. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't read the big book. You should read the big book. You should memorize the big book. You should live off the big book. Chew up the big book. All I'm doing is quoting from the big book. You live your life in the big book. But, you know, somewhere around 10 or 15 years sober, I got really, because you grow in here. You start growing. You want more, you want more, you want more. You know, blessed are those who are hungry and thirsty after righteousness. I wanted to be like him. I wanted to be like that guy. I see different guys. Why can't I be like that? Why can't I be like that guy? Why am I always worried about money? I wanted more. So when you want more, you go to those men who seem to have more. You go to those places that seem to have more. And so somewhere along the line, somebody shoved a book in my hand. You know what the book was? It was Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers Conference of Rue. And it was a book about what these guys were doing between 1935 and 1939, and actually a few years after that. You know, when they say, really, I've seen a person who's failed, has thoroughly followed our path? Well, the big book is a sort of rendition and a summary of what they were doing between 1935 and 1939, but it's not exactly what they were doing between 1935 and 1939. If you want to read what they were doing, you read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And you're going to read that book, and you're in for a lot of surprises. You're going to read that book and you're going to say things like, does AA know about this? I haven't heard about this in meetings. I didn't hear about all these Bible studies. I didn't hear about, you know, that the first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous was Bob Smith reading Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. I didn't know that the guys that developed this thing felt the books that were absolutely essential in order to attain, you know, maximum sobriety was Sermon on the Mount. You know, 1 Corinthians 13 and the book of James, that we were almost called. I didn't know that they were doing all this. So here's sometime before 1939, when the book was covered. Here is Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, I'll say doing a 12-step, but they didn't call 12-step at that time. They were witnessing to this guy, Bill Dotson, you know, right there. And you see one of these guys has a book. Does anybody see a book there?
Yeah.
That ain't the big book. That's the Holy Bible. That's the Holy Bible. Listen, that's the thing that the wisdom of the rooms will tell you you're not allowed to talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous. Even though it's all over the wall, even though it's all over the book, even though the book is based upon it, you know. Even though that thing, first things first, you know what first things first is? Dr. Bob coined that phrase to coincide with the phrase in the Bible, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all things will be added unto you. We have that in our big book, but it says, see to it, your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. The whole Bible is basically, the whole big book is a paraphrase of the Bible, the Holy Bible. And the only reason why alcoholics get mad when you talk about it is because they're alcoholics. And, you know, you can tell how alcoholic somebody is by how mad they get at stupid stuff like that. In fact, you know what I mean? So when you think somebody's bright, what they're really showing when they get mad at religion and stuff like that and talk about God, what they're really saying is, look at me, I'm not sober. I'm still an alcoholic. The hackles, did you know if you're an alcoholic, the hackles on your neck, whatever hackles are, they stand up. You look at somebody who gets mad about this, their hackles are standing up, okay? So they're talking, I mean, you know, you wonder about this stuff. You see these two guys are in suits. I mean, what kind of guy dresses up in a suit and takes a Bible down to the hospital to talk to a guy like that? Not any self-respecting alcoholics I know of. You got to have a lot of love for God and a lot of gratitude, which is probably why... in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3 in the story, which comes right after Dr. Bob's story, that guy Bill Dotson says the following. Yeah, this is in our literature, guys. He says the following. Alcoholics Anonymous number 3. It's right in your book. It's a here it is. Wanna find it. Alcoholics Anonymous, right after Dr. Bob's nightmare, which is probably why that guy standing on the bed when he got sober says the following. It would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, a something I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't gotten. And I remember one day, a week or two after I'd come out of the hospital, Bill was at my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch, and I was trying to find out why they had this release that they seemed to have. Bill looked across at my wife and said to her, "Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep talking about and telling people," which is essentially why I'm down here. I'm down here. I'm the same. You know, when I first read the big book, when you're an alcoholic and you're out there, and you're trying to battle the world, and the world is winning, you know what I mean? You're at war. And you know nobody could possibly understand you. Because nobody could possibly understand your problems, because you're so unique. And you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you read this book all about the drinking and the feelings and everything, and you hear people talking, and you say, man, that's just like me. And all of a sudden, you know you're not unique. You know, it's like an incredible thing. It's an incredible thing that there are other people that have drinking problems and drink like you. It's incredible. You know what's even more incredible? When you get into the rocket of the fourth dimension. When you get into the experiencing much of heaven, when you get into the gratitude and the stuff they're saying, you say, man, this is exactly what was happening to me, because then you know it's really happening. And you know, if you haven't experienced much of heaven, if you haven't been rocking the fourth dimension of existence which you had not even dreamed, you know what that means? That means it just hasn't happened to you yet. Doesn't mean it won't happen to you. Doesn't mean it can't happen to you. Doesn't mean it's not going to happen to you in the next 3 or 4 or 10 or 20 years. It just means it doesn't happen to you. But I'll tell you what it means. It means it's available to you. Just like this guy saw, I knew there was something more. Something I hadn't got. Something that a person ought to have. So if you don't have that, I got to tell you something. You ought to try to get a little bit of that. You ought to try to get a little bit of that drug. You know what I mean? Yeah, that's it. I got the amen section. That I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful that he had been released from this terrible thing, and he had given God the credit for having done it, and he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, "The Lord has been so wonderful for me, curing me of this terrible disease that I just want to keep telling people about it," has been a sort of golden text for the AA program and for me. That's the deal. That's what AA's all about. And I walk out of an AA meeting, some young kid comes up to me about 10, 15 years ago and says, "You're Russell?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "My sponsor says you're a good speaker. I hear you." He says, "But you talk too much about God." And I talk too much about... That's what the program's about. But you know what's interesting? That's the whole program. Look at the steps. It all's designed to get you to commit your life to God, to give your life to God, to turn it over utterly. It says we turn it over utterly to Him. And then you finally get the 11th step where once you finally got this relationship, you try to get stronger and stronger. It becomes the central part of your life. And then you tell people about that. And some guy in AA tells the sponsor he talks too much about God. And you know, he said that because somebody else was talking to him about that, and that's what you're battling out there and even in here. You need to understand that the book, the text, what is going to get you sober and keep you sober, not for 5 years or 10 years, but for 30 years and 40 years, to good purpose, the stuff that's going to keep you sober, you need to understand that the majority of people, even in AA, are going to tell you you're stupid for doing it. They don't want to do it. They don't want to go that far. They'll resent you for even talking about it. And, you know, most alcoholics are codependent. They worry about what other people think about them. I know you say, I don't give a crap what other people think about me, but, you know, I used to say that too, you know. I don't give a crap what they think about me, but, you know, yeah, I used to say that a lot. I don't give a crap what he thinks about me. I don't give a crap what they think about me. But, you know, after a while you realize that people who say, I don't give a crap what they think about you, really all they do is think about what other people think about them. Because people that really don't give a crap what other people think about them don't say, I don't give a crap about what other people think about them. They say, like, pass the sugar or something, but they don't say that. You know what I mean? So since we so worry about what other people think about us, you know, some guy in the room says, we don't talk about God, or keep that to yourself, and you get scared. You know, you're saying you're doing something wrong, and so you worry about people are going to talk about your name. But you know something, they can't kick you out. You know, they can't. Boy, I'll tell you, you wouldn't believe the power you have when you realize they can't be here. Jesus, Christ, whatever, you can say anything. You know, they can't, what do you say? I'm sorry, you've been voted out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all they do is they keep on inviting me to speak. Why? Why? Because when you speak the truth and you have the power and you're right and the book backs you up, people want to hear it because they want a message of weight and depth. They don't want to hear acceptance is the answer to all my problems. They want to know, how do I survive? How do I live? How do I grow? Tell me something more that's deeper because I want to do it. And it scares the phony balonies off. They're scared. They don't have any courage. We never apologize for God. Never, never, never. You know how I know that? You know how I know we never apologize for God? Because I've read the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to close with this, just in case you didn't realize this, I want you to know that in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says the following. It says, perhaps there is a better way. We think so, if we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? Why would anybody have an objection to people talking about God? The whole book's about God. Your salvation is about God. Everything in your life is about God. You're going to stop talking about God and stop reading because it makes some banana uncomfortable? Some guy who's going to be drunk anyway in a week or a month or 2 weeks or a year. You know what I mean? Or committing adultery or doing all sorts of crazy things because he doesn't really want this thing. You're going to let him dictate your life from now on? Don't you feel like you've wasted your life enough once you get in here? Don't you want to do the real deal? You really want to follow that bozo around because you're scared that he might not like you? We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is a way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once we start to outgrow fear. How would you like to outgrow fear? How would you like to outgrow fear and worry? You know, I said to Ray O'Keefe once, I said, when am I going to be financially secure? He said, never. You know, I'm one of these people. Anybody here ever worry about money? You guys are like wealthy, huh? Anybody here ever worry? Raise your hand if you ever worry about money. You ever do what I did? Like, I'd wake up in the morning and think about my bills I owe and how much money I have coming in, and then an hour later you think about how much money you have and how many bills, and then an hour later, then you start thinking about how, well, maybe your Uncle Henry will die and leave you $1 million, and you don't even have an Uncle Henry, you know, and you start thinking about the lotto, and you start thinking about that, and your whole life is money, 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 a constant radio show, a constant, like, music, money, 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 money. And you're reading the book, it says you're going to lose financial insecurity. And so I turned to the guy, because I went to meetings. You know what I was talking about? Money. You know what I was thinking about? Money. You know? And you know what the whole world is thinking about? Money. Right? They're all thinking about money. So you don't feel so weird talking about money, because everybody's talking about money. You know? Lifestyles of the rich and famous. So I turned to one of my mentors. And I say, when? I want the answer. Is it going to be 5 years, 10 years, 25 years, whatever the heck it's going to be? When am I going to be financially secure? Be able to have the Cadillac, have all the money in the world? And he says, listen to this. He says, never. I mean, time to get a new mentor, you know what I mean? Never. Yeah, try to want some of that prosperity gospel stuff, you know, so never. So I said, no, it says in the book, financial insecurity will leave you. He says, no, it doesn't. He says, it does. It's right in the book. It's in the promises, right? Financial security will leave. He says, no, it doesn't. He says, read it. He tossed me over a big book. He was driving. So I opened up. He says, read it. And it says, fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave you. He says, you see, you're always going to be broke. It just won't bother you. Thanks. I appreciate that. You know what I mean? But I remember I went to my sponsor once and I said I was mad because some guy bounced a check on me. So I was mad. Some guy bounced a check on me. So he said, well, let me ask you something. He says, what? He says, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, what do you mean? I said, well, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? Because I was talking around the rooms. I was talking about everybody. I was yelling about everybody. You wouldn't believe what happened to me. I was in a discussion meeting, after the discussion meeting, before the discussion meeting. Let's go out for coffee so I can talk some more about it. You know what I mean? You know, it never makes you feel any better. It only makes you feel worse. It's like alcohol. You know, you drink, you want more, you want more. You talk about how the guy's an asshole. You just want to talk about him more. You know? So he finally said to me, he says, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, what do you mean? How would you feel if it didn't bother you? What do you mean if it didn't bother me? Well, if it didn't bother you, how would you feel? What do you mean if it didn't bother me? If it didn't bother you, how would you feel? I said, you mean if it didn't bother me that he bounced a check on me and I've been in all sorts of trouble now? He says, yeah, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? If it didn't bother me that he bounced, how would I feel if it didn't bother me? Yeah, if it didn't bother you, how would you feel? I said, well, if it didn't bother me, I'd feel okay. And he said, there you go, and he walked away. You know, my problem is I hung around with those type of guys too long and they warped me. They screwed me up. So even though things may happen to me that's bad or good, I somehow don't notice them because they don't bother me like they bother you. You know? They don't bother me. So guys come up to me and tell me all their problems and they're all upset and I say, so I don't understand, what's the problem? I said, what do you mean what's the problem? I said, I know, she left you and this, that, and the other thing, so what's the problem? Well, you don't understand. I said, I understand, but I don't understand the problem. Why are you upset? I don't understand what, you know. Nobody wants to talk about why they're upset or what's it, you understand what I'm saying? You know, if you're alive on the planet Earth, you're going to get cancer. You're going to die. People you know are going to die. You're going to have financial problems. You're going to have all sorts of crap's going to happen to you. That's sort of like the world. That's life. That's the way it is. Everybody's going to die. It's going to happen. What's the problem? Well, I don't understand. What's the problem? Why are you worried? What's the problem? It's life. You know, it's life. You don't like that, just kill yourself. You'll be dead. You know, you won't have to worry about that stuff. You know what I mean? What's the problem? That's life. Go out there and help somebody else. Stop whining. Stop sucking your thumb. God bless you. Thank you very much.